You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about the extension of Michael Gabelman's Republican-backed investigation into the 2020 election here in Wisconsin, and we'll hear a political scientist's argument about why it should be ended. But now, farmers markets are starting back up for the season. Some produce you might see as you walk around, turnips, radishes, greens. Maybe you've got those veggies grown in your own garden. Our next guest tells us how to make the best of spring's bounty. And you can join our conversation here at 800-642-1234. Are you excited to get back to your local farmers market? What produce is your favorite? What are you looking forward to? What questions do you have about cooking with rhubarb? 800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. With us now is Ian Knauer, chef, writer, and farmer. He's the author of a cookbook called The Farm, Rustic Recipes for a Year of Incredible Food. Welcome to the show, Ian.
Hi, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
I'm so glad you could join us. Now, I just have to ask, because we are having the slowest spring here in Wisconsin, except for this week, which has been crazy hot.
Yeah.
What's the spring been like for you so far?
I'm here in eastern Pennsylvania. It's been pretty much the same. We had cold weather, cold nights, so we couldn't get anything in the field. And then all of a sudden, it was like 80 degrees this week. It's been a little wonky. But we're headed to summer eventually.
Yeah. So a lot of the traditional spring produce that you might expect to see at your first farmers markets feels like it's a little behind.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. In fact, the stuff that we have a farmers market tomorrow and the stuff that we're going to be bringing has been grown in high tunnels and greenhouses, just to make sure that we have stuff for the start of the market for this season.
Yeah. So what makes you most excited for spring? What comes to mind? What is it?
As far as food goes?
Yeah, pick a favorite.
Oh man. I love spring veggies because they've just been so it's just been such a long winter, you know. And so we eat what we grow, and we have a lot of storage crops, but that basically means that we're eating beets and potatoes and turnips from like November until now. So anything that pops up in the spring, I get excited about. One of my favorite things, and it's an early riser, is watercress. Yeah. I love watercress that grows in a stream. It tastes totally different than stuff that you can grow even hydroponically, which never made any sense to me. I don't know why that's the case, but it's so true. You know, wild watercress is just like the sharpest bite. It wakes you up. It gets you ready for the season. I love it raw, but I also love to cook with it. In fact, it makes one of my favorite sort of like creamed spinach dishes. I like to use watercress instead of spinach. I thicken it with a potato. So I boil a potato and then I add the watercress to the pot at the very last minute, drain everything, and then puree it with a little heavy cream. So it's super simple and it's got so much more flavor than creamed spinach. So it's a really great side for a steak or a grilled piece of chicken.
That sounds great. So how do you recommend folks find it if they don't happen to live in a place where they've got a stream next door?
Yeah, that's a good question. And so I've actually been experimenting planting it. So you can order watercress seed from any seed company, and they're little tiny, teeny tiny seeds. And I found a stream near our house, and I went and I tried sowing the seed in the stream. And it didn't work because we got a heavy rain. It all got washed away. So what I did this year, which has been successful, is I started the watercress seed in flats in our greenhouse. And I just kept it really soaked until it had established a little bit of a root system. And then I transplanted it into the stream and it totally took. It's thriving. And so probably by next season, I'll be able to harvest enough to eat. So that's been a fun experiment.
And I got to ask about asparagus. You have it yet?
Yeah, we do. We're about halfway through our asparagus season. What do you want to know about asparagus? Asparagus is one of my favorite things.
I wanted to know how you cook it because I feel like people have very strong feelings about this. What is your favorite way?
All right. So if you go to France and it's asparagus season, There will be, you go to a fancy restaurant, you can order a side of asparagus and it costs like 30 euros and it's worth every penny. Because here's what they do. They go outside, they cut it, and they cook it and then they serve it. The longer the asparagus is, sits between the harvest and the plate, the less flavor it has, the less texture it has. And so like, it's one of those things, like if you have an opportunity to cut it or you live near a farm that grows asparagus, ask them when they're going to harvest it and then show up that day. So here's what I do. Here's my favorite way to cook asparagus. I like to peel, it's old school, but I like to peel the bottom end of the asparagus with a vegetable peeler.
Okay.
And then I put the asparagus in a skillet of room temperature water and I add some salt to that. And when I'm ready to cook it, I turn on the heat and everything comes up together. The water and the asparagus come up in temperature together. What the reason is because then you get a really even cook. If you drop your asparagus into boiling water, what you get is sort of mush on the outside and not quite cooked on the inside. And yep. Sometimes the tip starts to fall apart because the tip is a little more tender. But if you bring everything up together, then you get this totally even cook. It, depending on the thickness of the asparagus, it's going to take between 4 minutes and 7 minutes. And then I like to take it out just a minute before it's totally tender because it keeps cooking. If I'm going to serve it hot. If I'm going to serve it cold, which I also love, I will take it out exactly when I'm happy with the texture, and then I'll throw it into some ice water to stop it from cooking. So and that's my favorite way to cook it because you have so much control over it, and you really – let's talk about that peeling again. The reason like I like it peeled is because the bottom end is always thicker, right? Yeah. And so if you take the skin off the bottom end, then the top end and the bottom end cook at the same time. So you don't get mush on top and hard on bottom. You get totally even cooking.
I gotcha. And then what do you put on your asparagus, if anything?
One of my favorite things is a mustard vinaigrette with some capers in it, some olive oil, some lemon juice, or you could use like a tarragon infused vinegar would be nice. And then the finishing touch is I take a hard boiled egg and I force it through a mesh sieve so that it becomes what's called a mimosa. And it's sort of like, is confetti over top of the whole dish.
Nice. We got a comment from a listener. James wrote to us on Facebook, and James says he loves creamed asparagus on toast with some pink Himalayan sea salt or Himalayan salt, black pepper, and topped with some Parmigiano Reggiano. It's
that
a real treat.
Delicious. Yeah, I mean, creamed any vegetable is right up my alley. And I also like how simple it is, because it's a good asparagus, like you don't have to do that much. So it sounds like James adds a little cream, a little salt and pepper, and of course the Parmesan, and like that, and that's where you need to stop, right?
Yep.
So don't mess it up.
And can you taste the difference between like foraged asparagus versus actually planted asparagus?
I don't know that I've ever eaten foraged asparagus. I've seen it on the side of the road in some places, but I never stopped to pick it because I always figured it was somebody else's.
fair enough. But that's definitely a big thing here.
Yeah, I would imagine that there would be a difference. I mean, anytime you have something wild versus something that's cultivated, you definitely get a difference in flavor. So I would imagine that there would be a difference.
And cutting versus snapping, do you have strong feelings?
I usually cut to harvest and then I snap.
Oh.
Yeah, because each spear has its own breaking point, so they're all sort of unique in that way.
Yeah. And I wanted to ask you about radishes because sure. I saw your recipe and it's something I had never considered, making a soup out of radishes.
And that soup is actually a cold soup, which is nice for weeks like this one when you have 80 degree days out of nowhere. And all you have are radishes because they're the first thing that pops up in the garden or on the farm. That soup's really fun because it uses buttermilk as its base. And so you get sort of the tang and the creaminess of the buttermilk. And it really helps balance the bite of the radish because the radishes in that recipe are raw.
Yeah.
And so everything gets blended together and you get this really sort of refreshing cold soup. It's a really fun recipe. I make it every year.
And what do you recommend if buttermilk isn't a thing that people have in their kitchens? If they don't have it handy, what's your favorite trick?
So my favorite trick to fake buttermilk is to take, let's say, a quart of milk, because usually people have milk in their fridge, and a couple tablespoons of lemon juice, and mix that together. Just keep it cold. You don't have to heat it up. But if you mix together the lemon juice and the milk, what it does is the acid of the lemon juice actually starts to very slightly curdle the milk. So you get that sort of viscosity that you get with lemon juice, and you also get the tang. So that's an easy fake to make buttermilk if you don't have it in your fridge.
Yes, I love it. We're speaking with Ian Knauer, chef, writer, and farmer. He's the author of The Farm, Rustic Recipes for a Year of Incredible Food. And he's with us today to share some tips and recipes on spring produce. We'd love to hear from you. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Have you ever tried your hand at foraging? How's the mushrooms coming? We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue this conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. Right now, we're speaking with Ian Knauer. He's a chef and an author, and he's telling us the best ways to prepare spring produce. So, Ian, I'm so curious about mushrooms and what you find where you are.
Sure. We have a lot of mushrooms here. Pennsylvania is a woodsy, damp place, and that's what they like.
Yeah.
This time of year, of course, we have the noble morel, which is one of my favorite mushrooms, yes, not only to cook with, but to try and find.
Have the fun.
They're sneaky little buggers. They hide really well because they're brown, just like, you know, just like the leaves. And so you really have to like adjust your eyes to try and find them. You know, it's even sort of like baked into the language. You forage for mushrooms, you hunt for morels. And so like, right, there's so much more difficult and therefore so much more rewarding when you find some. And when it comes to cooking them, I like to keep it as simple as possible. Morels have just a beautiful, woodsy, earthy flavor. And so all I do is I saute them in a little butter, and then I sprinkle them with a little salt, and that's it. And depending on how many I find, I'll either toss them with pasta, or I have actually been out for hours and only found one. And so I'll come back and just saute it and put it on a little piece of toast and just eat that one mushroom.
Savor it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, we had a listener that called in. Keith from Green Bay was wondering if the hot weather will hurt the morel season this year. What do you think?
Well, they had a long run of cooler weather, which is obviously what they like. And so they had an opportunity to get really established. The last week or so, since it's been getting warm, they're just going to kind of like bolt like cilantro does. And they'll just exponentially increase in size. So if you're going to go out, it's probably a good time to go out now, because then they turn into little Christmas trees at some point. Not that you can't eat them then, but they're just a little unwieldy.
Yeah. Well, I want to go to the phones now, where we have Kathy joining us from Presque Isle. Hi, Kathy. What's on your mind?
Hi. Say, I have access to a lot of wild ramps. And I know that they can be used like an onion or garlic almost, but I'm wondering if your guest has a favorite recipe or two that he likes to use ramps.
I bet he does.
Hi, Kathy. Ramps are my favorite onion. I absolutely love them. I love them raw. I love them cooked. I love them in soup. Let's see. Okay. So let's just start with pizza. So if you're going to put ramps on your pizza, which I highly recommend, make a bechamel. So cook a tablespoon of butter in a tablespoon of flour, and then add a cup of milk. Bring that to a boil with a pinch of salt until it's thickened. That takes about 8 minutes. Use that as your sauce. So then you spread out your pizza dough. You spread your bechamel over that. And then you take the bottoms of the ramp, so like the bulb and the white or pink part, chop that up and sprinkle it on. Bake your pizza. And when it comes out of the oven, lay the leaves, the green part, on it, and they'll just sort of wilt as on the hot pizza. They don't need a whole lot of cooking because you want to preserve that sort of like really deep woods flavor that they have. So that's one example. Another thing to do is ramps and nettle, stinging nettle pop up at the same time. So if you find some ramps and some nettle, cook an onion in some butter, and we're going to make a soup. Cook an onion in some butter, and then add some chicken stock. Bring that to a boil and throw your nettle tops and your ramps in there for like a minute. Puree everything. Add a little bit of cream if you want to. And then that is the like maybe the most delicious spring soup you can have. It also cures everything. So if you have a cold and you make that soup, like it'll be gone. So those are two examples. Basically anything with ramps makes me really happy. Another quick tip on ramps. I could talk about ramps for hours.
do you ever pickle them?
Oh yeah, totally. They're really nice with a quick pickle.
Yeah.
So equal parts vinegar and water and a little salt and a little sugar. Heat that up so that you dissolve the salt and the sugar, and then pour those right over the ramp bulbs. The leaves don't pickle as well, but the bulbs pickle really well. There used to be a bar that I used to go to when I visited friends in New York, and they would serve a martini with a pickled ramp bulb, which was really very classy.
Nice.
So that's a fun thing to do too.
Yeah. What
ramps
was your tip?
Transplantable. So if you find ramps at the farmer's market or in the woods and you use them, you can always replant the stem. So if it has roots on it, throw those in the ground, cover it up. They sort of like a rocky hillside, if you can find that, and check again next year, and they will have popped up if they like the conditions that you put them in. So that's a really fun way to, you know, if you live near woods, spread the ramp population so that we can keep enjoying them.
Nice. Well, I want to ask you about fava beans, because you have a very cool recipe for fava beans, and I feel like these are underappreciated. I don't feel like they're very widely known or used.
Yeah, outside of Italy, you don't see them a lot. Italy and California, I guess.
Yeah, but they're delicious.
They're so good. Oh, my God, they're so good. And the coolest thing about fava beans is that you can eat the entire plant. So fava beans grow, and you can eat their leaves. You can saute their leaves with a little butter, throw in a dash of soy sauce at the end, and it's just like, it's so delicious. You can also eat, of course, you can eat the bean, right?
Yep.
You can eat the skin that's around the bean. And then, a lot of people don't know this, you can eat the pod. And so fava beans come in this like 6 to 8 inch sort of like spongy pod. And most people just throw that out. They peel the bean, then they blanch the bean, and they just serve the bean. But those pods are really fun in like a tempura batter fry. And so make a little tempura batter with some, like a loose batter with either, you can use beer as your liquid or seltzer water. Dip your fava pod in there and then deep fry it. And it will become super crunchy and super soft on the inside. And I just like, fry them and dip them in mayonnaise or ketchup and just eat them like French fries. So it's a really fun plant. I grow them here. It's the first thing I plant in the spring. I plant them mid-March because they're frost tolerant and they do not like the heat. So mine grew about 8 inches this week because of the heat. So I'm hoping it cools down a little bit.
So like you would peas.
Exactly. Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah. And where do you recommend folks find them if they're looking for some, looking to try some?
I would think a high-end grocery store that has a good produce section would carry them this time of year. You can always find a good grocery store and ask the produce manager. If they get enough requests for them, they can order them in.
Yeah. Well, and I would be remiss if I did not ask you for your favorite recipe for rhubarb.
Rhubarb favorite recipe. Well, that's tough.
Well, I hear that you have a good one for drinking it.
So I love a rhubarb Collins. You make a simple syrup, so equal parts sugar and water, and then blanch a couple stalks of rhubarb in that simple syrup. Blend it and strain it. And then what you have, of course, is you have a rhubarb simple syrup. And with that, you can add some lemon juice, a little gin, top it off with some soda water, serve it on the rocks. It's such a refreshing and also beautiful little cocktail. I mean, you don't have to put the gin in it, but, You should.
Why not?
So it's such a pretty color that it feels really classy just because of the color. You know, that the red of the rhubarb translates into this like really pretty pink in that cocktail.
And it's got vitamin C, right?
Sure. Yeah, it's a healthy one. Why not?
Well, Ian, what spring vegetable do you think is often underrated or overlooked?
Oh, dandelion.
Really?
Because it's everywhere, yeah. First of all. And it's delicious in lots of different forms. I do two main things with the dandelion that I find. I take the greens and I make a hot dressing. So I cook some bacon and I save the bacon fat. And then I whisk together an egg and some water and a little vinegar and a little sugar. And then I cook that in very slowly in the bacon fat until it congeals and gets a little thick. And then I toss that hot dressing with the dandelion, and it just ever so slightly wilts the dandelion, and the sweetness and the richness of the dressing help balance the bitterness. This was actually my grandmother's recipe. And then, of course, you take the bacon that you cooked and you sprinkle it over top. The other thing that I like to do with them is I like to make capers. So you're familiar with capers, of course,
yep.
the Italian little flower bud that's brined and pickled. Just before the dandelions pop up, I go outside and I pick the buds. It takes forever because they're so tiny. And then I take them home, wash them. I put them in a salt brine for about a week. They lactoferment. That means that they start to get a little sour and they absorb some of that salt. And they themselves are very bitter. And so you're starting to see some balance here. Then I take them out of that brine and I put them in a vinegar mixture and I just keep them in my fridge and use them just like capers.
Ian. We are out of time. I could talk with you all day.
Oh, me too.
Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, this has been so fun. Thank you.
That was Ian Knauer, chef, writer, and farmer, author of The Farm, Rustic Recipes for a Year of Incredible Food. We've been talking about in-season produce. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Molly Stenson for Rob Ferret. Now, this week, Michael Gableman and Ravin Voss signed a new contract. The former state Supreme Court justice and the assembly speaker who hired him agreed to extend the taxpayer-funded contract for an ongoing investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin. Gableman's investigation has been paused while several lawsuits relating to it move through the justice system. And we would love to hear from you. Have you heard much about this investigation? Gableman has previously said it provides reasons for decertifying the 2020 election results here in Wisconsin, something that election experts and Ravin Voss himself have said is legally impossible. Perhaps you're tired about hearing about this. How do you think it ends? We'd love to hear from you. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can always post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. With us now is Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief. Sean, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Molly.
Hey, Sean. So why did Michael Gableman need a new contract?
I mean, the shortest answer is that he was working without one there for a while, and it's not the first period of time where he has been without a contract since he was hired by the state assembly and by Ravin Voss to oversee this election investigation as their special counsel. But that absence of a contract, the periodic absence of a contract, had become an issue off and on in some of the cases where Michael Gableman is either a defendant or, you know, a plaintiff or kind of a tangential defendant. You know, there were questions by judges about what his formal relationship was. And so this formalizes that. And he is definitely, according to this document, working for the assembly now still as a special counsel. And, you know, this is also, there's been this question about whether or not Speaker Voss might say, you know, we're done with you, Michael Gableman. Your investigation's over, time to move on. Every time that seems like it might be a possibility. You'll see former President Donald Trump himself issue a statement coming out strongly in favor of Michael Gableman and urging Voss to stand by him. So, you know, the question of whether and how long Mike Gableman is working for the Assembly has been an ongoing one, and it is going to be an ongoing one now for who knows how long.
Yeah. So there's no expiration date on this contract.
Yeah, the way that the contract is worded, it's set to terminate upon conclusion of all outside lawsuits involving the investigation. So what might that mean? There are a couple cases where there's a hearing in one of the open records cases for June 10th. There's a hearing in this really big subpoena case that Gableman has brought against the mayors of Madison, Green Bay, and Racine, among other elections officials, where he's threatening to jail them if they don't comply with subpoenas to sit for private interviews. That case doesn't have a hearing scheduled until July 11th. It's already been delayed a few times as, you know, what Mike Gableman is seeking has changed. And those are just hearing dates. You know, it's not saying there's going to be a decision by a certain date. And you can imagine that a decision might be appealed. So we really don't know how long these things could stretch on if they have this sort of indefinite nature to, you know, the word in the contract and, you know, and the cases.
Yeah. And so what do we know about what Gableman has been working on recently?
I would say we don't know too much about what he's been working on since he issued his, you know, I think he called it an interim report back in March. It was initially billed as a final report from Speaker Voss. That is not how Michael Gableman billed it when he presented it to members of the Assembly's Elections Committee. And, you know, in that committee, he, I would say, largely talked about Elections Commission policies when it came to running the election. And he did highlight some specific instances where elderly voters voted in the 2020 election, and played video for members of the committee where these voters were interviewed by a private attorney and the voters appeared confused. This is the hearing, the report where he suggested that lawmakers take a hard look at decertifying the election, something that the legislature's nonpartisan attorneys have said is not possible, something that Mike Gableman's own attorney in one of these cases has said is not possible, and, you know, something that's not going anywhere. You haven't heard Republicans say, let's move forward with this. Speaker Voss has taken some heat in the base for saying you can't do it. So your question is what's happened since then? Yeah. We don't really know. I mean, that was where Gableman kind of made a big splash. What's happened since then is he has kind of been a presence among the group of Trump supporters who, you know, are election conspiracists and has traveled the country, spoken, you know, to Trump himself, has become a name in conservative circles, if he wasn't already. I don't know what he's done beyond that in terms of the investigation. He hasn't issued another report since then.
But he's still got this contract with the state being paid.
He has a contract now for being paid $5,500 a month, down from $11,000 a month. And the contract also calls for paying $2,100 a month to cover his rent at an office where he's renting space. So it's down from what he was paying before, being paid before, but he is, you know, he's on the payroll. And we don't know exactly how much the lawsuits connected to this investigation are going to end up costing. You know, the speaker, the initial contract with Gableman called for $676,000 for this investigation. But, you know, Gableman has been involved in a lot of court cases, you know, the one of which he's brought himself. And so these have gotten expensive, and we don't know the extent of what that billing is going to cost.
Yeah. Well, we've got some calls coming in for you, Sean. Let's go next to Madison, where we have Scott on the line. Hi, Scott. What's your question?
My question is, when is somebody going to step in and arrest all of the people involved with this fraud? There is quite obviously nothing found, and all they do is continue to spend money and spin lies.
Okay, Scott, it's a little hard to hear you, but I heard you asking about fraud. And with regard to this investigation, in that there has been little documented evidence produced out of this investigation regarding election security and election fraud.
Yeah, and I also was having a little bit of a hard time hearing. And so it's kind of a critical question, though. Scott was alluding to arrests there. And, I can say that the actual instances of voter fraud, you know, we know are very rare in Wisconsin. There have been some charges this year, but it's in line. The charges connected to the 2020 election are in line with what we've seen in previous elections. And voter fraud itself is not specifically alleged in Gabelman's report. It alludes to sort of an illegal administration of the election. It alleges this in the way that the Elections Commission and others administered the election. It does not, it's not like a list of alleged fraud.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing on my mind is that the midterm campaign season is heating up. We've got the primary coming up in August. We see candidates for governor staking claims here about the election. How big a factor do you think this is going to be?
It's definitely a factor for the Republican base. I mean, Speaker Voss announced the hiring of Michael Gabelman at the Republican State Convention last year. The Republican State Convention this year is coming right up, and you have an active primary for governor right now. And none of the candidates at this point have been endorsed by former President Donald Trump. That endorsement would be huge in a competitive primary like Wisconsin's. What's the singular issue that Donald Trump is concerned with in his public statements? He talks about the election nonstop and Wisconsin's election nonstop. He falsely asserts that he lost. He falsely asserts that he won. And so he wants a candidate who will say that. He wants a candidate who will say, I want to fight to overturn that erase. And he also wants to get a candidate, though, that, he thinks can win the election, because that's important to buttressing his, political strength as he weighs a 2024 run for president. So the reason the election issue is such an issue will continue to be an issue among, candidates running for higher office is because the former president wants it to be, and the GOP base is not ready to stop talking about it either.
Well, we will continue to follow this and look to your reporting. Sean Johnson, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Molly.
We've been talking about updates on former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman's investigation of the 2020 election. Next, we're going to hear from a Wisconsin elections researcher who says the investigation is a waste of taxpayers' money and dangerous for future state elections. We'll continue this conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Molly Stentz in for Rob Ferret. We'll continue talking about the ongoing investigation into the 2020 election in Wisconsin being led by former state Supreme Court Justice Michael Gabelman. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss just inked a new contract with Gabelman, extending his investigation with no expiration date. Our next guest has a new opinion piece up online in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It will be out in print this weekend. And he's calling for the investigation to end. Our guest is Barry Burden, professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at UW-Madison. Barry, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Molly. Glad to be here.
So, Barry, why do you think this investigation needs to be stopped?
Well, there are many reasons. I think it was going in the wrong direction from the outset. Gabelman, even before he was appointed to this role, expressed skepticism that Joe Biden had won the election fairly, and that seems to be a conclusion that he is trying to build evidence to support. His scope of the study has ranged from things like voting machines to voter rolls to elderly people being coerced, to grants being given to municipalities, drop boxes. So there's sort of a range of things that he is scouring, hoping, I think, to produce evidence for his conclusion. But really, the whole affair has been bumbling and incompetent. He said in a couple of interviews at the outset of the project that he didn't have an understanding of how elections work in Wisconsin. And I thought that was a shocking statement from a former Supreme Court justice who had actually ruled on election issues, including things like voter identification requirements, which were controversial and went to the state Supreme Court, redistricting cases that went to the state Supreme Court. And now I think the concern at the moment, which we express in this op-ed, is that he's continuing to pester election officials, especially in larger cities, who are in the midst of planning for the August 9th primary and the big November general elections, but are having to deal with subpoenas, requests for information, and demands being placed on them that are just unreasonable and distracting.
So why do you think it continues?
It's hard to say. I think Gabelman himself has suggested that he has a sincere belief that there were major problems with the election and he wants to uncover those. So far, he has not done that, in my opinion. He's issued a couple of reports and testified before the legislature. He's also traveled the country speaking at events. He went to Mar-a-Lago and other places. But most of those appearances are raising questions and suggesting things are out of line. There's a kind of, you know, connecting of the dots almost that suggest something's amiss, but has never quite proven it. And I think wants to do that. And I think he's also sort of bristled under the criticism that he's gotten from some fellow members of his party and from election professionals who are trying to do their jobs. And he really wants to prove himself right. So it's not about the money as much as people have raised concerns about his salary or the budget that's been given to his team. I think he would do this unpaid. I believe he even offered to do it for a dollar in the most recent contract negotiation. So it seems to be a kind of dogma on Gabelman's part that he wants to bring to fruition.
What impact do you think it's having on the election system that we have, both the people working in it and then also voter trust in our elections?
Yeah, I think it's had really damaging effects in both of those areas. We know that some members of the electorate, especially supporters of Donald Trump, have suspicions or doubts about the 2020 election. Gabelman has said that one of his purported goals is to address those criticisms and concerns, suspicions, but I think he's actually furthering them by raising questions and not answering them in a convincing fashion. And, you know, just the incompetence and rambling nature of his investigation is really making groups more suspicious. And he's actually speaking at their rallies and talking with election deniers and election skeptics who believe in the big lie. So it's having a counter effect in terms of public opinion. And then election officials who have really been under pressure and faced unbelievable stress in 2020, trying to run an election during a pandemic and while facing unprecedented levels of threats and personal harassment, are continuing to feel that. The pandemic situation may be better, but they are continuing to get hard criticism and in some cases, you know, personally threatening messages or harassing messages by people who have bought into Gabelman's narrative. And they are trying to deal with all of the legal things that Gabelman is throwing at them, threatening to jail them, demanding that they meet with him in secret to undergo depositions and those kinds of things. So it's a major distraction in a very busy election year when there have already been two elections this year and two more important ones yet to run.
Yeah, and that's what strikes me is that meanwhile, you know, elections happen, the system moves on, and we have had elections, and there have not been similar criticisms and calls of rigging the election here in Wisconsin in the spring election.
It's true. I haven't heard any major concerns about the February or April elections that happen across the state. And actually, in Gableman's investigation of the November 2020 election, he has focused on the presidential race only, which was at the top of the ticket, but not the many other races that were also on the ballot, including members of Congress, most of the state legislature. In his last presentation to the state legislature and in his report that Sean mentioned, he suggested that the presidential election results might be decertified. He says the evidence points in a direction that would support that. But if he thought the election was really fraudulent and failed, wouldn't he also want to decertify all of the other elections down the ballot? He
right.
has not proposed that. So the logic doesn't fit and isn't supported really by any convincing evidence.
I mean, have you seen evidence that this is impacting public faith in elections? I mean, I'm thinking about the latest Marquette poll that showed the vast majority of Wisconsinites do have faith in their elections and the electoral system.
Yeah, that's an important message for us to remember. Most of the public is pretty confident about the election. They heard the messages that it was secure and proper and picked the right winner. Doesn't mean that it was a perfect election. I think there are things that ought to be tweaked, especially in an election with an unprecedented amount of absentee voting during a pandemic with some new practices in place. But most of the public feels comfortable with what has been done. But I think the Gableman investigation is continuing to raise doubts among that segment of the public that had doubts right after Election Day when all of those lawsuits were being filed and there were questions about the electors and the Electoral College. Normally, those kinds of concerns, especially from people who voted for the losing candidate, you know, people have sour grapes for a while and then they tend to fade. But after 2020, they have not faded. And this investigation is keeping them alive at a time when really the public and election professionals need to turn their attention to the next round of elections.
Yeah. And are you watching other states in addition to Wisconsin and these election investigations?
I am. It's unfortunate that a network has developed of election skeptics in key swing states around the country, and they are in communication with one another and coordinating with one another. Some listeners may have heard about the review that happened in Arizona, in Maricopa County, after the election there. Arizona was also a swing state. A private group called the Cyber Ninjas were tasked with a big investigation, review, audit, whatever you'd like to call it, lasted many months, took many millions of dollars, and produced essentially nothing credible at the end of the day, a big report and lots of questions. But they ended up inviting in legislators from Wisconsin who came to visit. Michael Gableman apparently traveled to Arizona to visit. He's been to other seminars, including people like the MyPillow CEO, Mike Lindell, who is part of the election skeptic community. So they're reinforcing one another's doubts about the election by communicating across state lines.
So what are you, as we wrap up, what are you watching now on this front?
Well, I want to make sure that people who are running elections, our nearly 2,000 clerks who serve every municipality and county around the state, stay in their jobs and are willing to stick it out even in these difficult times. It's a difficult job. You know, many of them serve part-time and have other things to do and are just facing criticism and demands and threats against them, including you know, threats that they be jailed.
Yeah.
We need to protect them.
We will keep an eye on it. Thank you, Barry, for joining us today.
Glad to be with you. Thanks again.
Barry Burton is a professor of political science and director of the Elections Research Center at the UW-Madison. We've been speaking about the election investigation by Michael Gableman and Barry's piece in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that will be out on newsstands later this weekend, and it's up online right now.